Live from New York City, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Talking on a telephone will be for the rest of this week because we are in the process of really expanding our studios. We are inviting other producers onto the air. We have about 100 new voices on progressive themes. We have a new progressive news hour broadcasting from around the world to show you what's happening outside of the United States, very narrow echo chamber of all things Trump all the time, and we believe there's a lot more going on in this world than about Trump. And so we decided to do all we can to expand our coverage, and we are the number one progressive radio program in the world right now. And so we're just making it easier for more people to tune in and easier for more broadcasters to get their voices out. That'll be completed by the weekend, by the way. Today and tomorrow and the next day, we're going to be talking about health and nutrition. Of course, yesterday was the first whole half hour. But today I'm adding in 5G. Now, I'm sure many of you have seen the ads. The ads show of cities that are connected with high resonating electromagnetic frequencies, meaning that you can get a message from point A to point B much faster. Do we really need that? No. And what's the danger? Well, the establishment, meaning Verizon and all the telecom giants and the FCC, will say there is no problem there. But there is. And the Federal Trade Commission, which is involved in this, the Federal Communications System, the FCC, all these different government agencies, the FDA, the CDC, all of them should be paying attention to the independent science. How much is there? 10,000 studies. How serious is it? It's serious enough, 5G, the 22,000 scientists signed a letter protesting it and saying we shouldn't go forward with it. And then I played some clips last week, if you remember, on WBAI from a 10-year-old hearing where they were talking about 1 and 2G was dangerous and caused brain cancers and glioblastomas and high levels of inflammation inside the jaw, the neck, the brain, the lymphatic system. And that was before Congress, under oath. There was a panel of 6 scientists. They were not industry scientists. And then they talk about how the industry, using propagandists and scientists for hire, were trying to downplay the risks. So, right now, unfortunately, the media is complicit. Virtually every single one of the mainstream media has said that this is an important new technology and we can benefit from it, and there's no harm. That is simply not true. So we're going to go into that in greater depth. Then I wanted you to hear something that, even though it's after the fact, it's still going on. And it's the same identical blueprint being used everywhere else in the world. Here's how it works. The European Union, a completely corrupt organization, they have 27 member nations, 17 using the same currency, but it's really controlled by Germany and, to a lesser degree, France. And you remember the man who was caught up in the scandal of using the prostitutes? He was the most powerful financial man in the European Bank, and he was going to run for the presidency of France. So what he was doing was this, because it's not that easy to completely understand the guest I'm going to have on, who was the former minister of finance of Greece and tried to protect the country. But they would give gigantic loans, huge loans, into the almost $200 billion to help the failing economy of Greece. So the German government and other governments would give money. It would then go to Greece, go right into a bank, and come immediately right back out again, and go right back to France and to Germany. So that their banks, that have made a lot of very careless and reckless bets on derivatives, and the credit default swaps, and lost hundreds of billions of dollars so they wouldn't look bad. He didn't want to look bad. He looked like he was saving the French economy so he could get elected president. Had he not had that sex scandal, he would have. That was the game they were playing. But no single journalist, no one from the New York Times, CNN, Washington Post, NBC, nobody covered that story. We did, right here on BAI. We had him on the air, the British, the Minister of Finance. But what were the consequences of the people of Greece? Well, they took their pensions and took out about 30%. So if you were taking home $1,000 a month as a retired professor, you're now taking home $700. Could you live on $700? The answer was no. So you had to go out and you had to look in grocery stores if there was any produce they were throwing away so you could take it home and eat it. It got so bad that a year later they were dumpster diving. They were looking in dumpsters. Crime was rampant, homelessness was epidemic, and the entire city's infrastructure simply collapsed. Then they opened up for part two. So you can't pay us back what you owe us. So therefore, give us your assets. They started to privatize the airport and the islands and the transportation system in their harbor. Everything you could privatize in Greece, they did. These were all insiders. These were the inside-the-belt friends with lots of money who could go in and pick up something dirt cheap, much like privatizing, you know, parking meters in Chicago. That's how it works. And so the people not only had their sovereignty taken away, they were criticized for being the lazy Greeks, and they weren't lazy. And then they had debt they had to repay that they never got. So that's the real story. So you're going to hear him. I just want to let you know, because some of it you'll be able to understand fairly easy, others you may not, what he's actually saying. And then, time permitting, we're going to have the piece I did not have a chance to get to yesterday, and that is the attack on everything male in the United States Day, because it's politically convenient. And one of the people doing this attacking is someone who I really would love to debate, but she won't come on and debate. And this is the so-called liberal Sherpa. And you see her around. She's the one who says that you should never change the diet. You should never touch your baby, not even to change its diapers, not even to pick it up if it's crying, because unless you first get its permission. Now think about that. You've got a baby. The baby's got soiled diapers. You want to change the diapers, and any reasonable and responsible parent would, because you could get it infected otherwise. But you can't, because you first have to get permission. Well, exactly how are you supposed to get permission from a baby if you're allowed to touch it? That's how insane these idiots are. But there right now, they got a microphone. So it seemed like anyone who can get their hands around a microphone or get on television is suddenly an expert on everything. They're also the ones who are now coming with the idea that if you listen carefully to what I'm going to tell you, because this is real, that if you and your wife or you and your partner are walking down the street, you cannot just reach over and grab their hand, hold their hands as you're walking. You first have to get permission, and you have to know that that permission is authentically given. Otherwise, it's considered assault. When you go to bed at night, you cannot cuddle your partner. To cuddle your partner or your wife or husband would be a violation of their physical rights, which is no different than physical assault. So in effect, trying to cuddle or love your partner is assault to these people. And these people happen to be the people that unfortunately are given some credibility that they know what they're talking about. And they don't. So I'm going to challenge them today when they said that eating cauliflower was no different than supporting racism. Whoa. Whoa. What in the world are they thinking? The trouble is they don't. I'll address that in my own commentary. Let's begin with the latest from McGill University, which is up in Quebec, and they found that cranberries are really a powerful natural and non-toxic antibiotic to fight bacteria. Now, we we should be concerned because the global spread of antibiotic resistance is undermining decades of progress in fighting bacterial infections. And due to the overuse of antibiotics in medicine and agriculture, we are on the cusp of returning to a pre-antibiotic era in which minor infections can once again become deadly. Therefore, countering the fall in antibiotic efficiency by improving the effectiveness of currently available antibiotics is a global goal. And cranberries are highly sought after for their tangy taste and their antioxidants, but a new study published in the Journal of Advanced Science provides evidence that they could also help in the fight against bacteria. So when treated with molecules derived from cranberries, pathogenic bacteria become more sensitive to lower doses of antibiotics. But by themselves, in and of themselves, unsweetened cranberry juice is one of the best things you could take if you have a urinary tract infection. If you have yeast overgrowth, it's very good for you because it really kills a full spectrum of urinary tract bacteria. So that's a good. It also helps with gastroenteritis and can help that as well. Even if you have pneumonia, it can help. Now, I always suggest that you add some colloidal silver to that and olive leaf extract, 1,000 milligrams, and elderberry about... Now, some of you in this audience are old enough to understand the power of elderberry. Those of you who may not have experienced it, elderberry is one of the single most powerful medicinal, functional berries in the world. I believe that every American should have about a teaspoon of elderberry concentrate in the morning. Throw it in your smoothie. It's very sweet tasting, but it's extremely good for you. So when you take all that and you add in some lemon juice and ginger, then you're getting full spectrum antibiotics, and that can help with almost any inner body infection. From the University of Geneva, which is in Switzerland, music helps to build the brains of very premature babies. In Switzerland, as in most industrialized countries, nearly 1% of children are born very prematurely, before the 32nd week of pregnancy, which represents about 800 children annually there. Now, they have advanced neonatal medicine, now give them a pretty good chance of survival, but these children are at high risk of developing neurophysiological disorders. So to help the brains of these fragile newborns develop as well as possible despite the stressful environment of intensive care, University Hospitals of Geneva proposed an original solution, music written especially for them. And the first results publishing in our most prestigious medical journal, the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, are surprising. Medical imaging reveals that the neural networks of premature infants who have listened to this music, in particular network involved in many sensory and cognitive functions, are developing much better. So soft, very soothing music can make all the difference in the world. So if it's going to help the preemies, it would also help the full development, and therefore mothers should now consider putting on very soft, meditative music, harp music, flute music, violin music, and this can help that developing brain. So that's good. Also, eating pineapples can clear up eye floaters. This is a brand new study from the Chajin University in Taiwan. And this was published in the Journal of American Science, and it found, quite simply, eating pineapples regularly can significantly reduce eye floaters. I'm sure many of you know that an eye floater is a dark spot or a series of spots that appear in one's vision and are caused by age-related changes that occur as the jelly-like substance, the vitreous, inside your eyes becomes more liquid. That's according to the Mayo Clinic. And as this vitreous shrinks with age, microscopic fibers form inside and tend to clump, casting tiny shadows on the retina. But they found at the Department of Pharmacy in the Department of Ophthalmology Hospital that having pineapples made all the difference in the world. And we're talking about from 100 to 300 grams. Now, 20.53 grams to an ounce, so you're talking about 3 ounces to maybe 9 ounces. So if you had 100 ounces, 100 grams a day, that's 3 ounces. For 3 months, that's how long it takes. That's a small amount. That's not even a cup. That's a half a cup of pineapple. And I suggest that you also have the middle section of the pineapple, the very pithy core, because that's where you get your greatest amount of an anti-inflammatory enzyme. Also, one of the reasons you should be interested in having your blood chemistry checked is to check your LDL cholesterol, the low-density lipoprotein. Why? According to Veterans Affairs Medical Center and Emory University, if you have high LDL, it's an indicator of an early onset Alzheimer's. Now, I'm seeing Alzheimer's in younger people in their 40s and 50s today. They have dementia. And dementia is one larger field in which Alzheimer's is one part of it. And this was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association's Neurology. So there's many things you can do to bring your LDL cholesterol to a normal range. The three things I suggest to normalize cholesterol: 1, stop eating all meat and dairy; 2, start taking a high level of the omega-3 and omega-6 fatty acids, coconut oil, flaxseed oil, like a teaspoon of each day, and nut butters, or eating nuts, like walnuts, or you grind them up and you have walnut butter, almonds or almond butter. So you have those and your LDL cholesterol starts to go into the normal range. And that can help protect you from, you know, one of the more serious conditions we have in our society, Alzheimer's. Also, B-complex at 50 to 100 milligrams can make a difference as well. A lot of people are drinking the energy drinks. I don't recommend it. They're extremely dangerous. This is the latest study from the University of the Pacific, published in the Journal of the American Heart Association. It says drinking 32 ounces of an energy drink in a relatively short time period can increase blood pressure and the risk of electrical disturbances in the heart, which affects heart rhythm, and that could end up causing a heart attack. That's your energy drinks, and that's because of the caffeine. And you don't realize that you're getting upwards of 400 milligrams of caffeine, and that's enough to induce any electrocardiographic changes. You're also getting some of the carbonated water in there, artificial flavors. Stay away from caffeinated beverages. They're really dangerous. Don't recommend them at all. Also, from Scripps Institution of Oceanography and the University of California at San Diego, did a study, and they found that eating fish rich in omega-3 fatty acids is good for your brain and heart. However, an alarming study warns that consuming fish contaminated with toxins can harm your immune system. This is published in the Journal of Science Advances. And why am I concerned about it? Because I just finished an article. I'm going to present it tomorrow here on WBAI for the first time. It's an article that both supports Congressman Cortez's new green plan, but I read that entire plan, and it's so vague and overgeneralized, it's not going to mean a lot. You need scholarship. You need details. How do you do something? What are the priorities of doing it? And what timetable do you have to do it in? And without that very specific matrix structure, nothing will get done. It'll just be a series of platitudes and platforms, and we've already had plenty of those from every congressperson and that wants to get the green vote and the president. Nothing's happened. Nothing. Just the opposite. So I'm going to show how do you actually do that. How do we save the world, in effect? That'll be on tomorrow's program. It'll be about a half hour long. In any case, as a lifelong environmentalist and conservationist and an organic farmer, there are right ways and wrong ways of doing things. And one of the things you have to pay attention to is a pollution that is a massive polluter in one part of the world ultimately will pollute other non-polluted parts of the world. For example, we can find plastic in Alaska, in the whales, in the orca whales, in the gray whales, humpback whales, and that's not good. And once Fukushima occurred, most people, 7.5 years ago, felt that's taken care of. They're doing the Olympics there, coming up. They're actually going back and farming in Fukushima now. That's correct. They are. And yes, the Olympics are going to be held right by there. And yes, shortly after leaving Fukushima, not far away, you have the largest city on the planet. From 43 million people living in the surrounding area, and almost 39 million just in Tokyo. And Arnie Gunderson, who I interviewed, went to Tokyo and took samples on the roofs of buildings, in school playgrounds, on the streets, from one end to the other of Tokyo prefecture, and found radioactive contamination higher than what is allowable by the law. And yet nothing has been done about it. So what exactly has happened to all that radiation coming out of Fukushima? Well, it has not stopped. It's going right into the Pacific Ocean, 100,000 gallons a day. So what does that cause? It's caused a 1,000 miles by a 1,000 mile dead zone. First of all, radiation is super hot, and it overheats the water. Secondly, it kills everything in it because the animals first develop gross cancers on their body, but also the temperature rise itself. Unless an animal is able to swim out of the area and find new feeding grounds, it will die because of the heat. At Indian Point, which is just above New York City, about 28 miles directly up from New York, you have Indian Point nuclear facility. There's two of them there. That means there's two giant tubes that go into the water, the Hudson River, and they draw about a billion gallons of water a day. That water is super hot when it returns back into the Hudson and kills over a billion fish a year. What else it just does, we don't know because they haven't done the tests on it. So we do know this, that contamination years ago reached the west coast of the United States. Clear up to Alaska, we've been seeing cancers in aquatic animals, plus you have all that seaweed that has grown in Japan, where all the water's contaminated, plus all up and down the west coast of the United States. And by the way, remember, it has to go right past Hawaii to get to the United States. All the islands and landmass in between have also been adversely affected. Has there been any Marshall Plan to change it, to go in there and create a gigantic sarcophagus like we did with Chernobyl, meaning bury it under a gigantic mass of concrete? No, nothing. It's still dangling. 1,200 spent fuel rods are dangling in the air, and the third building. So what are we going to do about it? How about nothing? Absolutely nothing. That means that everything in the ocean that a person would normally eat and feel okay about eating, you shouldn't eat anything from the Pacific Ocean. Nothing. That means no seaweed, no fish of any kind. If you're going to eat fish from the Mediterranean, like sardines. That's the safest, healthiest fish on the planet to eat would be sardines, and the most rich in nucleic acids. But stay away from fish from the Gulf of Mexico, and stay away from fish from the Pacific. And that's what this study is about here, the contamination of what's in the ocean. Now, also from Deakin University in Australia comes a study about vitamin C is linked to reduced glucose levels in type 2 diabetes. That means when you take vitamin C, you're improving the blood glucose levels in people with type 2 diabetes. So the more vitamin C you take, the more even, level, normal your blood sugar becomes. They're suggesting 2 500-milligram doses of vitamin C a day. I would say that's way too little. I would say like 1,000 milligrams 5 times a day would be much better. And since I work with people with diabetes all the time, every day almost, then I know what it takes to help their blood sugar level. But I'm glad they did this study because at least they're acknowledging for the first time, hey, vitamin C can help with type 2 diabetes. Well, it also helps with pre-diabetes. We are 26 minutes into our program, and our final study comes from Ruhr University in Germany, and it's how stress leads to Facebook addiction. So let's just try to understand this. Friends on social media, such as Facebook, can be some source of comfort to some people during a period of stress. However, if they don't receive any real support offline in their day-to-day lives, stressors usually are not at risk of developing a pathological dependence or are at risk, and they go right back to social media because you'd rather have a friend that you don't know as a friend, don't even know who they are, you just know a profile, and they're saying, you know, something good to you, and you rely more upon those people's advice than the people in your day-to-day life. And hence, you could have 1,000, 1 million, 10 million people liking you on Facebook, and you begin to become addicted to their shares and likes and photos, and here's what they ate for breakfast, and then that does not change your stress, nor does it help you. And students are particularly under stress, and they're living on Facebook, and they feel that they're getting a deeper sense of connection or engagement with Facebook than they do in real life. If that's the case, you definitely need some help. And from Hebei University in China, green tea protects against secondary osteoporosis. That's good. That's really important for us. That's the latest on health and healing. We're 28 minutes into our program. I'm Gary Null. We're going to take a break and come back, and we're going to come back into a discussion of, we're going to come back and take a look at everyone's, we're going to look at this whole Europe's hidden agenda of how they're giving tens of billions of dollars every month to corporations and countries, nothing to the individual, and for all intents and purposes, the euro would be worth nothing, and the European Union would collapse if it weren't for the gamesmanship of France and Germany and Great Britain manipulating everything to their advantage. Back in a moment.
And you're listening to The Gary Null Show here over listener-sponsored WBAI in New York. WBAI is at the tail end of our fundraising drive. We're asking you to call 516-620-3602. Become a member. Support The Gary Null Show and WBAI.
We're going to go to an audio clip now, and this is the professor, a very wise man and a very courageous man, because he did something that's rare. He stood up to the entire European Union financial oligarchs, the European Central Bank, the International Monetary Fund, and he told them, what you're planning to do to bail Greece out is a fraud. You're not giving us money. You're saying you're giving us money, but you're turning around and taking it right back. and keeping it for yourself, and then you're cutting all of our standard of living. You're making us go through an austerity program that isn't fair. It isn't right. But they did it anyhow, and they got away with it. No one's exposed them since then. So we're going to hear from him now. We'll play about 7 or 8 minutes.
Professor Yanis Varoufakis, thank you for speaking to us.
It's a great pleasure.
This is your new book, Adults in the Room, kind of a tell-all memoir of featuring secret meetings with Larry Summers, people phoning you in the middle of the night, threatening your stepson because you're saying bad things about the bank, secret recordings from Eurogroup meetings. Why did you write this?
Primarily because the story of Greece should not really matter for the rest of the world. Greece is too small. It should matter for us Greeks. But it shouldn't really matter to you in Sweden, to the Brits, to the Americans. But Greece is a little bit like the canary in the mine. It died in order to warn the rest, the miners down the mine, that there was a systemic problem, a methane leak, let's say. And the way in which the powers that be, the liberal establishment, which is now protesting Donald Trump and Brexit and Le Pen and so on, massively mishandled the Greek crisis, is indicative of the way in which the liberal establishment has lost the plot internationally after 2008. So the reason why it is in English and why I exerted so much effort in putting it together and not just publishing a Greek book in Greece about our country's problems is because I think that it's a universal story. And it's also a kind of drama, because very often I caught myself in meetings with very powerful people who were caught up in a trap of their own making in a way that only Shakespeare can relate.
The title Adults in the Room, that comes from Christine Lagarde, head of
the IMF. At some point she said that we need adults in the room in order to have an agreement. But it's an expression that she did not invent. It's an expression that, in a sense, relates and reflects the contempt that the establishment has for the people. They refer to themselves as adults. And, of course, the children are the masses out there who supposedly are the source of all legitimacy in a properly functioning democracy.
So Sweden hasn't joined the euro. We had a referendum in 2003.
Thankfully. Pursued.
Did we have a lucky escape?
Absolutely.
Why?
Because the euro, the idea of a common currency is splendid. But this particular common currency, the way that it's been designed, it is as if it was designed in order to first create huge capital imbalances, capital flow imbalances, inflate gigantic bubbles, which then burst naturally. And then once you have that, you have depression in the deficit parts of the Eurozone, and deflationary forces creating the circumstances for bigots and xenophobes to rise up in the rest of Europe. This is the architectural flaws is the reason why you should not have been part of it, and we shouldn't have been part of it either.
So in your retelling of this story, the Greek bailouts, it's not about Northern Europe coming to rescue the lazy Greeks who'd been dancing all summer like grasshopper, not thinking about the future, but it's about the Eurozone rescuing French and German banks. How?
Well, look, it's very simple, isn't it? 2008, great financial crisis. All the banks went bankrupt throughout the Western world, every single one of them. In the United States, the elites and the institutions are very pragmatic. They got around the table and immediately pumped up the quantity of public money, of dollars, and effectively reflated the collapsed banks. In Europe, we had created a central bank on condition that it's not allowed to do that. So if your central bank cannot reflate the inane and deflated banking sector, and the banking sector is insolvent, the only alternative is to shift quite cynically the losses from the books of the banks onto the taxpayers. So the Greek bailout was nothing more than a bailout for Deutsche Bank, Finance Bank, BNP Paribas, Societe Generale, the French and German banks. Between them, they had lent 200 billion to the Greek state. They were already insolvent because they had stuffed their boots with toxic derivatives from the other side of the Atlantic. And they had already been bailed out by the French and particularly the German government, and Mrs. Merkel could not go back to the Bundestag and demand another wad of money for the same banks that she had just saved. So it was packaged as an act of solidarity towards the lazy Greeks, which of course has to be to come attached with austerity strings, you know, tough love. In reality, this was money that went from the German, Slovak, Portuguese, Irish taxpayer to the Greek state to go straight back to the French and German banks on conditions that guaranteed to shrink the incomes of the Greeks that were not enough to pay for the old debts, let alone for the new ones. A 10-year-old can tell you that this cannot end well.
Because in the book, you're very critical of this, obviously, but you also express understanding for why Dominic Strauss-Kahn, Christine Lagarde, even Mrs. Merkel do this at the first instance.
Understanding is not the same thing as excuse.
No.
Or legitimacy. I believe that whenever you talk to someone, whenever you try to negotiate with someone, you should try to see things from their perspective. Does not mean that you agree with them. It does not mean that you excuse what they do, but that unless you have this capacity to get into the shoes of the other person, then you are not going to have a civilized discussion. My discussions with Christine, with all these people, were very civilized. The trouble was that they did not have the political degrees of freedom to come clean about what they had done, because they had effected a crime against logic. Lending the largest amount of money in the history of capitalism, in absolute terms, not relative terms, to the most bankrupt state in Europe was a crime against logic, especially when they did it under conditions of such harsh austerity that guaranteed the diminution of the incomes from which those loans... Now, of course, they didn't expect to get their money back. But they could not bring themselves
and
to telling...
And they didn't want their money back.
They wanted their money back, but they wanted other things more than the money. They wanted to preserve and maintain their own power structure. In particular, in our case, given that we opposed them, we got elected on a campaign to restructure the debt when they didn't want to restructure the debt. If they had come to an accommodation with us, a compromise, a mutual compromise, find common ground, a mutually advantageous agreement, they would have gotten more money back than they are getting now. But Spanish voters, Irish voters, Portuguese voters, Italian voters, and ultimately French voters might have gotten ideas in their heads that they could have opposed Lagarde, Merkel, Schäuble, Hollande, and so on and so forth, and achieve a better outcome.
Now, that was a professor of finance. I had him on this program years ago. And the reason I played this is because once something's past us, we tend to no longer consider it important. And yet the same rules of engagement, bail out the banks, bail out the major corporations, privatize assets of weaker companies, take over weaker competitors, and consolidate the power. That's what we did in the United States through TARPA, $21 trillion. And nothing went to the small homeowners to protect them, and nothing went to small businesses. They did that to Greece. Now, Greece is trying to get back up on its feet. Much of its infrastructure has been cleaned up. There's been a lot of different groups have gone into Greece to help them out, but a lot of their assets were privatized, and a lot of Greece has lost its sovereignty. So I just want you to know the game that the people in power play. They were playing it then, they're playing it now. By the way, I'm going to do a commentary on Joe Biden, but just remember this, before you vote for him because he is the good successor Democrat to Obama, Joe Biden didn't just support the war on drugs, he wrote most of the legislation behind it. So every person who has gone to jail for possession of marijuana and spent 7 or more years there, who's disrupted their families, who's had their ability to work at jobs that they would have had otherwise destroyed, you can thank Joe Biden for that. He also was against he was for the private prison system. I've got about 50 things that are wrong with Joe Biden, and I believe that we should start looking at the credibility of legitimate third-party people instead of just more of the same. I'm also going to play another clip now, and this is on 5G. because 5G is quite simply one of the most dangerous technologies in world history. Unlike smoking, where you can choose not to, unlike drinking, where you can choose not to, with 5G, once it's implemented with 20,000 satellites, you're going to have 5G everywhere. You won't be able to go any place on this planet without being affected by 5G technology. It's extremely dangerous. And it's already on the buildings. It's already in the neighborhoods. And people who never thought that they would have environmental illnesses are coming down with what is known as a high level of radio frequency sensitization. The headaches, migraines, insomnia, irregular heartbeats, digestive problems, that's just the beginning. And there's also cancers behind this as well. Here's a short clip on why we should be concerned about 5G.
We've heard a lot of hype about 5G, and today we're going to expose some truth and find out what it's really about. What is the 5G cellular network, and what exactly is it capable of? What does the equipment and hardware look like, and what should you watch out for? And the most important questions, is there a deeper agenda behind 5G? And how does it relate to things like mind control and energy weapons? Find out now on today's edition of Edge of Wonder, the truth about 5G.
Welcome to the Edge of Wonder. We're your hosts. I'm Rob.
And I'm Ben. It seems that everyone is talking about 5G in the recent months, and we've been seeing it all over the news.
Many of y'alls have been requesting it in the comments and in our inboxes.
Today, we're finally going to put this one to bed. In part one of our two-part series, we'll go far and cover what 5G is and everything that it's capable of.
Causing cancer, controlling consumer behavior, 5G weapons. I mean, we have got an episode for you today. Let's get everyone on the same page. What is 5G?
5G is the fifth generation wireless technology that's currently being developed and implemented around the world to replace 4G LTE. Get this, it's supposed to be 100 times faster.
Yeah, 5G relies on higher frequency waves like millimeter waves to support faster speeds and improve your mobile experience. You'll see faster downloads and upload speeds, and for men, it's so fast your beards may even burn off while you're using it.
Maybe. The delay in communication between devices and wireless networks, known as latency, will decrease. 5G is low latency.
What's the current state of 5G cellular technology? According to the FCC, 5G will operate on three different spectrum bands in the US.
There's low band, mid band, and millimeter wave high band. You can think of these spectrum bands as roads and data transferred as the cars on the road.
The straighter and more direct the road, the faster that the cars can drive on it. The same analogy applies here.
Without going into too many specifics here, basically, these higher frequency waves can't travel as far. Sort of like how at home you have to be close enough to the Wi-Fi device to get a signal.
5G stations can only cover less than 1 square mile, so it'll only work with an expansive network of antennas on top of existing infrastructure.
So what does this technology look like? What should you be looking out for?
If 5G has been rolled out in your neighborhood, you might see microcells or small boxes hung up on existing telephone poles, streetlights, or off a side of a building. You might also notice that you grow another head, or your leg falls clean off on your midnight 7-Eleven Slurpee run. You know you still drink those.
So in order for these cell phone and other devices with 5G capabilities to communicate with these 5G small cells, they need a 5G chip.
Qualcomm released its new Snapdragon X555 5G modem, which can run on 2G through 5G and promises to, quote, significantly boost the speed, coverage, and responsiveness of wireless networks. That was a mouthful.
That was. 5G will support autonomous vehicles, additional surveillance cameras, remote-controlled heavy machinery, you know, advancement of Internet things.
Our community probably already understands where this is going. Surveillance, remote-controlled heavy machinery, super smart appliances, and we've only scratched the surface. I mean, let's just introduce Hal and the Terminator into our homes.
Isn't that basically what we have with Alexa, like the Amazon thing? Like turning on by itself, doing weird things?
Exactly.
Well, so anyway, at best, Edge of Wonder videos will load faster on your phones, and at worst, Big Brother is watching you, or we should say the deep state in this case.
No. It's not like that. Let's go one level deeper. I mean, I've been alluding to it. How does 5G actually affect people, Ben?
In an appeal to the United Nations, over 240 scientists and doctors with published research from 41 nations listed out the side effects of exposure to non-ionizing electromagnetic fields, or EMFs.
I have no idea how you survived that paragraph. What falls under the category of EMFs? EMFs includes radio frequency, radiation, RFR, cellular and cordless phones, their base stations, Wi-Fi broadcast antenna, smart meters, and baby monitors. I mean, baby monitors? Ugh.
How do these EMFs affect us?
Effects include increased cancer risk, cellular stress, increase in harmful free radicals, genetic damages, structural and functional changes of the reproductive system, learning and memory deficits, neurological disorders, and negative impacts on general well-being. General well-being, I mean, this just sounds terrible. Actually, even the Epoch Times highlighted an occurrence where 150 dead birds fell out of the trees and onto the ground of a park in The Hague, Netherlands due to a nearby 5G network antenna.
Dr. Martin Paul, professor emeritus at Washington State University and a leading EMF expert, spoke at the National Institute of Health about the dangers of 5G.
He expressed his concerns that EMF effects will lead to existential threats to our survival.
Okay, that was just a short piece. You can listen to the entire discussion along with reading the article on the dangers of 5G because Richard Gale and myself wrote a definitive article. It has everything that's wrong with 5G, all from peer-reviewed science. We cite the 10,000 studies against 5G, the 22,000 scientists who signed the letter. The letter is in quotes so that you can read it and you can download it and use it to give to the members of your building on your block so that you can keep the trees. By the way, they'll cut down all the trees on your block because it has to have a straight line of vision to work. And so they're just decimating trees on blocks all over America now. So you can stop it. Now, the Clintons rigged this originally when they said that the telecom industry will be the ultimate arbiters of whether or not they believe it should go into a place and no one else can decide for them. Boy, what a gift to the telecom industry Clinton gave there. In any case, we're still fighting them. And in some cases, we're winning. We found that four children, normal children, came down with cancers, rare cancers, from the 5G on a regular school, and they got it off the entire playground. But we've got to get people in communities. You've got to download my article. I've got all these audio clips and these experts testifying before Congress. So take the audio files and then hold community meetings and share these with the local community. All right? We have to become proactive on this. I'm going to finish our program today by addressing a commentary from this liberal Sherpa, she calls herself, when she said that something to the effect that eating cauliflower, you know, was supporting racism. It's one of the dumbest things I've ever heard. If she had said, as Cortez alluded but did not define, what is the real problem? The real problem is not cauliflower. There's nothing wrong with cauliflower. In fact, cauliflower has indole carbonyl, an anti-cancer agent, and isothiocyanates, which can also help with cancer. It's a very important vegetable we should be eating. And the woman had no knowledge of the soil, no knowledge of agriculture, no knowledge of community gardens or organic gardens or sustainable agriculture. As someone who has taught thousands upon thousands of people at the Fertiller Farm upstate for over 14 years, how to farm, how to grow, how to tend to the soil, you realize the problem is industrial farming. And industrial farming is based upon economic colonization of agriculture. Now, that's a fact. That's where you get big agra, like Monsanto, for example. And you take thousands of farms and you get incentivize them to grow soybeans. And then you give them the glyphosate, the fertilizer Roundup, to kill the weeds instead of using natural weed barriers. And then you have a single crop, a monotheistic crop, corn, wheat, soy, whereas we don't want that. Not only do we not want that in the United States, we certainly don't want it in other countries. We want to get back to feeding people sustainably, and the only way to do that and do it in a healthy way is localized organic gardens. Remember, when you're considering the environmental consequences of growing something, let's say you grew a tomato in Mexico and you shipped it to Vermont. That's traveling over 6,000 miles. That's a huge carbon footprint. Whereas if you grew that same one organically in Vermont during the season and then hydroponically inside, you wouldn't be using water resources. You could grow it organically, and you could have it 12 months a year. Therefore, you're not relying upon having something shipped to you. You also then would be breaking the bonds and the chains that link corporate domination of our food to us. Now, we have this all the time. The Brazilians right now, under the ruler that they have, this new president, are destroying the rainforest, the lungs of the planet, that is the greatest sequestering of carbon on the planet, that in the boreal forest, and they're stripping out thousands of acres per day to grow soybeans to sell to the United States and China. Whereas if we grew soybeans only as one crop, and in the wintertime, you don't harvest the soybean out of the ground, you bury it in, meaning it's called a green fertilizer. In the spring, you go through your crop and you bury the overgrowth of that soy product, and now it enriches and gives nitrogen and minerals back to the soil, enriching the soil. So using the word racism was the wrong word. If you wanted to use the correct word, I would use agricultural economic colonization. That would be the right word. And saying that because cauliflower is white, it represents a symbol of racism is just stupid and vulgar, and we shouldn't tolerate this. This is the identity politics, and this is what's ripping America apart. What we need to know, and this person clearly is so clueless they don't know, is that food is not racist. Food comes from all over the world, and we need to grow food from different places and give our heirloom seeds to other countries so they have a greater variety, greater diversity. Give plants, for example, that require very little water and can sustain high heat. Give those to countries that have little water and high heat temperatures. Because a lot of times, like with Australia, their fruits are boiling, literally boiling, on the branches. They had the largest destruction of their crop this year because it was too hot and they didn't have anything take its place. Just a little background. Cauliflower originated on the island of Cyprus. And you can go back and read historical Arab texts to show that it was being used by the Arabs. Then it journeyed to Syria, Turkey, Egypt, and eventually Spain, and from Spain into Western Europe. Plantains and bananas originated in New Guinea. And that's why the Portuguese first called the guineo. And it belongs to the same family as ginger, turmeric, and cardamom. And the Quran identifies plantain, the tree, as the mythical tree of knowledge. And Portuguese claimed it was discovered in West Africa in 1469, and was later taken to Panama by the Spanish priest Thomas de Belanga. And from there it spread throughout the Caribbean and Central America. And yucca, Y-U-C-C-A, I grow yucca, It's one of the names for cassava, and it was grown in Africa and also brought by the Portuguese, and it originated also in South America and in the Amazon Basin, and one of the oldest cultivated crops in the world. In fact, it can be dated back 10,000 B.C. In fact, when the Spanish arrived, they knew that corn and yucca were already there. Corn and maize were first domesticated in southern Mexico around 8,000 B.C., and later in the Andes a couple thousand years later. The tomato belonged to the farmers in Mexico, and it was first cultivated by Aztecs, and And then the Spanish brought the tomato to Europe, and squash and the spinach was originated in Persia, in Iran specifically, and taken to China via India and Nepal in the 7th century. Then the Arabs introduced it to Sicily in 1827. It's very popular among the Arabs along the Mediterranean. And then broccoli was developed in northern Mediterranean, meaning Spain, Italy, and Greece. Very common vegetable for the Roman Empire. And the potato first was domesticated in southern Peru and northwest Bolivia around 8,000 BC and was first introduced into Europe 16th century by Spanish people. And the cucumber originated in India, where it has the largest variety to this day, made its way to Europe by the Romans and Greeks. And first European cultivation was in France in the 8th and 9th century. Charlemagne grew it in his garden. And the apple, there at one time, there you realize over 3,000 varieties of apples in the United States alone at one time 100 years ago. But it started out in Central Asia. And then Turkey was the center because of the diversity of the Malus genus, which was the oldest cultivated fruit tree. And Alexander the Great credited with finding them in Kazakhstan in 328 B.C., and the Spanish introduced them into the New World, first in Chile. And it was first brought to the United States by Reverend William Blaxton in 1625. But he brought what was called the crab apple, a little tiny kind of bitter apple. Now, we do have foods that originated in the United States and by the indigenous culture, corn, amaranth, quinoa, sunflowers, yucca, agave, potatoes, sweet potatoes, sunchokes, tomatoes, chili peppers, avocados, cranberries, blueberries, papaya, pineapple, passion fruit, strawberries, squashes, peanuts, black walnuts, pecans, cashews, and maple syrup and vanilla. And then you have foods that were originated in the Middle East, like flax and oats and sesame and wheat and rye and chickpeas and lentils and carrots and cucumbers and leeks and lettuce and onions and parsley and almonds and mustard and figs. Then you had foods that originated in Europe, the black currant and pears and raspberries and bilberries and cabbage and parsnips and rapeseed and turnips and chestnuts and lots of herbs like caraway and dill and tarragon and thyme and oregano. And then in the Mediterranean, beets and broccoli and Brussels sprouts and cauliflower and fennel and kale and mulberries and date palms and cherries and olives and pomegranate. And finally, in Asia, apples and barberry and pears and coconut and durian, jackfruit, and rice, and barley, and millet, and eggplant, mango, and bananas. And in Africa, like coffee, and cola, and watermelon, and okra, and black-eyed peas, etc. So you see, every country has contributed different plants, different seeds, different genus. And we have had the benefit of being able to use these and to benefit from diversity. And now, those of us who believe in saving seeds, heirloom seeds, organic seeds, non-genetically engineered seeds for the future. So you see, it's not the seed or the plant that grows from it that's the problem. It is the corporatization of farming. It is monotheistic farming. It is the mono farm that is the problem. 20% of all global warming comes from factory farming, and 18% of that comes from methane from producing animals. So if we just did two things, if we started to have local community gardens who chose from a variety of seeds and plants and then had classes on how to build a sustainable community garden and share that with people in the community and then see how long you could go without having to order a product that came from someone else, somewhere else in the United States so you kept the carbon footprint low and then went vegan to a plant-based diet, which is the healthiest diet in the world. All science supports that. Lives a longer life, healthier, less disease, and get off meat. Then you're planting trees in your community. If we planted 1 trillion trees a year on the planet for the next 5 years, we could help stave off a lot of global warming. So you see, these are things we as individuals can do. We're not going to get the support of the government because they're already captured by the special interest. But we can do this ourselves. And it's being done in a lot of different places. So before we start using more words saying that a vegetable is racist and a person that eats this is racist, let's take a breath from this identity politics long enough to realize we need food and it's how we grow the food and where we grow the food.